Good morning. Happy Father's Day, whatever. I am about to do something that I really hate. I don't want to do it. I hate it when other pastors do it. I hate it when people do this in regular conversation. But I am going to tell you a story that makes me look good. Okay? I'm going to do that. I genuinely don't want to do that. But the story that I'm going to tell you is a story about a time that I showed up for a friend in what I think is you would probably agree after hearing the story in an extraordinary way. And I have to tell this story this way because I have stories of friends who have shown up for me in extraordinary ways. But to be very candid with you, I'm not prepared to share those stories with you. They reveal too much vulnerability about me and my family that would be just emotional vomiting in an inappropriate way in this setting. So I can't use those. I know stories of men and women that I'm close with showing up for their friends in profound ways. But the nature of showing up in extraordinary ways usually means, almost always, that one of them is in a really terrible spot. And those are not my stories to share. I thought of calling a friend last night and saying, hey, can I have permission to share bits of this without names, of course. But I thought, no, that's his story to tell. So I'm going to tell you my story of being awesome with those caveats. And if what you take from this, if we don't know each other well, and what you take of this is, boy, that pastor really is just full of himself and thinks he's great. Okay, but I've done the best I can to talk us off that ledge with a modicum of some self-awareness. A few years ago, a friend of mine that is really, really dear was going through just a compilation of awful things. He owns his own business, and it was struggling mightily. He looked at the runway of what he had in reserves and looked at the work that he had coming in and knew that his family had about 3 months or he was going to have to sell the house and change things in significant ways. He was in a place in his marriage where it had come to light that his wife had had an affair. And he wasn't sure what to do about that. And we had had many phone conversations about it. And it broke him down, and it walked them through some really difficult times. And I'm not here to make commentaries about what to do in the wake of that, but his justifiable decision was that he felt like that this marriage probably needed to end. As he reached that conclusion and as he faced the things going on in his professional life, his wife's family ran into something that I can almost guarantee you none of you will ever have to deal with. It was very public, it was very shameful, and it required all of her attention and all of her emotional capacity. So my buddy is put in this place where he has to show support for her. She has to be out of town a vast majority of the time to handle what's going on there. And he's reached a place where he's done with this relationship. He can't see a way to move forward. And yet he just has to stuff it for months at a time because it's not the place to have that conversation. And he felt like the walls of life were closing in on him. And one day he called me crying. And he said, Nate, I feel like I'm about to break. My wife's never home. I'm totally unhappy. My life feels crazy. I have to work. I have to do the things I have to do to work, but I've got three kids. His kids are 10 and younger. He's like, I've got three kids and a dog, and my house is a total disaster. I can barely get through meals. I'm not cleaning anything. I'm making it day to day. I need to work, but I have to take care of the kids, and I have to take them here, there, and yon, and I can't do it. I feel like I'm drowning, and I don't know what to do. And so I just let him cry, and I told him whatever you tell somebody on the phone when they tell you something like that. And then I went to Jen that night, and I said, I have to go to Atlanta tomorrow. And I'm going to probably be gone for about 3 days. And I told her what was going on. I was like, he's my friend. And you show up for your friends. And so the next morning, you know, work was easy to get out of because I only worked for 1 hour a week. So there was really nothing happening. If anyone has a life issue on a Sunday, don't call me. But, you know, Monday through Saturday, I'm your guy. So I get in the car and I drive the 6.5 hours to Atlanta, and I showed up at his house. And he hugged me, and we cried, and I listened. And I felt like the best thing I could do to help him was to be and forgive me for the insensitivity of the statement, but I think you'll get the heart behind it, to be a 1950s housewife. And so that's what I set about doing. I sent him to work. I told him I'll take the kids where they need to go. I cleaned up the house. There was flies around his fruit. I took it outside. I threw it away. I went to the grocery store. I bought new fruit. I cleaned the counters. I cleaned all the dishes. I got the grease out of the sink. I went to the grocery store and bought the food for the meals so he didn't have to think about dinner and he didn't have to think about breakfast. I vacuumed his house. When I was vacuuming his house, I noticed that his children's rooms were virtually unlivable. Food wrappers, open yogurt, fruit in the corner. I don't know if it was poop or pudding, but it was on the wall. And I cleaned that up. And then I noticed that his playroom was totally unusable. And so I cleaned that up, and I made some executive decisions about what to take to the dump that day. They have enough toys they still have not noticed. But for 2.5 days, I was just with my friend, and I just did whatever you're supposed to do to help your friend in those times. The reason I share that story is to illustrate to you something that I feel very deeply, and I bet in hearing that, it tugged on something that you feel very deeply, which is friendship is profoundly important. Having friends, not buddies, not pals, having friends who would do that for you, and he would do that for me in a heartbeat, and he's done forms of that for me. That pulls on something within us, because the right friendship, the right friends are sacred. And in the story of Jonathan and David, we have what I believe to be, as we go through the life of David this summer, we see what I believe to be the greatest story of friendship in the Bible. I think that Jonathan, in this story, and I'll give you some context for it, is the most honorable man in the Bible. And I actually thought that until I realized that to think that would be arguing with Jesus, because he says it's John the Baptist, so fine, I guess Jesus is right. But Jonathan's pretty good. For context to the story, you'll remember from the series so far, or perhaps when you've encountered it before, that Saul was the first king of Israel, and his son is Jonathan. Now, Samuel, the priest of Israel, had gone to David, directed by God, to tell David that he was the chosen next king of Israel. It would not be Jonathan that would succeed his father. It would be David that would move the throne from the family and the line and the lineage and heritage of Saul to the line of David. And so, practically speaking, it's offensive to Saul that his line will not go on and sit on the throne. But there's no one on the planet to whom it is more offensive and less advantageous than Jonathan. It would make all the sense in the world for Jonathan to despise David. It would make all the sense in the world for him to disdain David, to thwart David, to seek to sabotage David. because I don't know at what point Jonathan became aware of the prophecy, but I would be hard-pressed to believe that he went through his entire adult life up until the point where David ascended to the throne, or right before David ascended to the throne. I would be hard-pressed to believe that at some point or another, Jonathan didn't open his eyes to that fact, that that wasn't shared with him. I fully believe that in the discourse that we are going to read, and I'm just going to read portions of 1 Samuel chapters 18, 19, and 20. But I fully believe that Jonathan knew who David was and what the promise was, and had more reason than anyone in the world, and more reason than anyone normally has to not like someone, much less actually be their friend. So it starts off as an extraordinary example of friendship. And I'll also note, for those of you who are note takers, your bulletins, besides providing a place for you to write, are useless this morning. I rethought this sermon and scrapped all the notes that I wrote 3 months ago, I don't know how many months ago, but it was a while back. And I looked at it and I went, I feel like I don't want to preach that, and I feel like there's something else that's really on my heart that I do want to communicate. So you can use it for writing space, but they will not help you follow this sermon. With that context, we look at 1 Samuel chapter 18, verses 1 through 4. After David had finished talking with Saul, Jonathan became one in spirit with David, and he loved him as himself. From that day, Saul kept David with him and did not let him return home to his family. And Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. Jonathan took off the robe he was wearing and gave it to David, along with his tunic and even his sword, his bow and his belt. I have a friend who goes to the church, and we jokingly refer to one another as spirit animals. We are not of the same generation, but we should have been brothers. And this week, I saw something come up on the TikToks, or as my friend Kyle refers to them, the TikToks. And it's the title of the video said, I think I've met my spirit animal. And it was this llama, or I think an alpaca, that was putting its head out the side of a trailer, and it was trying to bite something on the car next to it. And so the driver in this car is honking at the alpaca to get it to stop, or to get the driver to notice. And the alpaca turns and screams at him, ah, and then spits right in the middle of the windshield. And this driver said, I think I just met my spirit animal. And I said it to my friends, and I said, spirit animals. And there are some people that you just connect with in that way. And that's pretty much how Jonathan and David were friends. You know, they probably shared alpaca videos back and forth. But they knew from the beginning, Jonathan sensed our souls are knit together. This is a brotherhood that surpasses some of the other people that I know. And it says that he loved David as he loved himself. And it says that he took his robe and his belt and his sandals and he gave it to David, which is nothing else but acknowledging you are going to be the one that inherits what I should inherit. You are going to be the one who sits on my throne. And rather than making you take it from me, I'm going to simply step aside and give you what's rightly yours. Here's my robe. Here are my royal accoutrements that you have. You take. Here's everything. You take it. And it is no longer my throne. This is the context for David and Jonathan. And then as we fast forward the story, what we see is Saul begins to develop a disdain for David. There's a song, because David's one of the generals in Saul's army, and Saul loves to send David out to fight his battles and win his wars, but he doesn't love the praise that David gets. And there's a song that they would sing that was made up in Israel that went, Saul has killed his thousands, but David has killed his tens of thousands, which I'm sure is a lovely song in the Hebrew, but in English it doesn't really smack that hard. But you see the point, that David was growing in renown and Saul was in atrophy. And so he became jealous of this. Another thing that Saul would use David for is Saul was prone to fits of what we would likely title depressive episodes. He was tormented. And he would get very sad and very cloudy and very down, and his life would get very dark. And the only thing he discovered that can pull him out of that was to listen to David play the lyre. And so David would come in and he would play his instrument, and it would buoy the spirits of Saul and restore him. And so one day David is doing this, and Saul was ruminating on the acclaim that David gets and became very angry. And hurled his spear at David, this text says, to pin him to the wall. And it says that David eluded that spear. But Saul was still enraged, and so he threw a second spear, and David eluded that one too, and then fled the palace. And this is where we see a very large difference between me and David. I have a very strict one spear policy. If you throw a spear at me in your home one time, I'm going to leave. That's my rule. But David has a two-spear policy, which I think is incredibly generous. So he leaves, and after he leaves, he's afraid. Saul wants to kill me, but Jonathan goes to his father and intercedes on behalf of David, again, with the context of who David was and who Jonathan was and what Saul was supposed to be and what David is told he will be. It's remarkable that Jonathan had any resolve whatsoever to defend David or to see him through. This is his big chance. My dad hates him. He's probably going to kill him. Now I can become the king just like I'm supposed to. That's not what Jonathan does. Rather, Jonathan goes to Saul in 19 verses 1 through 7. I'll read quickly because it's a lot of verses. Saul told his son Jonathan and all the attendants to kill David. But Jonathan had taken a great liking to David and warned him, "My father Saul is looking for a chance to kill you. Be on your guard tomorrow morning. Go in to a hiding place and stay there. I'll go out and do some stuff and I'll tell you about it." Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul, his father, and said to him, "Let not the king do wrong to his servant David. He has not wronged you, and what he has done has benefited you greatly." And then he tells of some of the things that he has done. And so verse 6 says, "Saul listened to Jonathan and took this oath, 'As surely as the Lord lives, David will not be put to death.' So Jonathan called David and told him the whole conversation. He brought him to Saul, and David was with Saul as before." So Jonathan goes to Saul, goes to his dad, and says, "Please make a vow, don't kill him." And Saul agrees to do this. He is assuaged from his wrath and his anger towards David. And so everything is good in the moment. But Saul was volatile, and it comes to a point where he is bound and determined to kill David. And David is talking to Jonathan about it, and they're very mournful, and they hatch this plan. David says, "I'm not going to show up at the banquet tonight. If Saul doesn't mind where I am, tell him I went to do this. If Saul doesn't mind, then we'll know that he's really not that concerned. But if he gets angry, we'll know that it's his intent to kill me, and he's kind of mad because I messed with his plans. He's going to have to kill me on Thursday, which is super inconvenient." And then whatever his response, "I'm going to go out in a field and you shoot an arrow. And if it lands in this place, then it means that I'm safe. And if it lands in this place, then it means that he wants to kill me and I need to flee." And so the next day, it doesn't go well for David. Saul was very angry at the banquet. And so Jonathan shoots the arrow beyond him, and he sends his servant out to go and fetch it and bring it back. And the servant goes off with the arrows. But Jonathan and David know that this means that David has to leave because his life's in danger. And they know that they will likely never see each other again. They know that this is the end of this friendship that means so very much to them. And in chapter 20, verses 41 and 42, we see their goodbye. And there may be parts of this goodbye that make us uncomfortable, and we're going to come back to that, actually. But this is how much they loved one another deeply. "After the boy had gone, David got up from the south side of the stone and bowed down before Jonathan three times with his face on the ground. Then they kissed each other and wept together, but David wept the most. Jonathan said to David, 'Go in peace, for we have sworn friendship with each other in the name of the Lord, saying, The Lord is witness between you and me and between your descendants and my descendants forever.' Then David left and Jonathan went back to the town." This is the story of Jonathan and David. when David realized he had to leave, they hugged each other and they wept, grown men, and they kissed each other, as was the culture. And it says that David wept more than Jonathan because they knew they wouldn't see each other again. And then David left. Now there's two reflections that I want to share with you from that story. There's many more to take out, but there's two that I want to share with you this morning. The first one is this, and this was actually pointed out to me yesterday, I think by my dad. And this is why your notes don't matter anymore. Because I was like, oh yeah, that's better than what I had. I'll preach that. David in the Old Testament often is what we call a type Christ. There are times when David in the stories represents Christ. He is not Christ. We do not get confused about that. David was not a messianic figure that somehow imbues part of Christ. We don't get the two intermixed in our theology. We don't get confused about that. David was a man. He was very sinful. He's very human. He's very imperfect. He was not Jesus. But in some of the stories, he has the honor of playing the part of Jesus. And in this story, it happens in this way. What we see, if David represents Jesus, what we see in Saul and Jonathan is a stark, helpful juxtaposition of their reactions to David's arrival in their lives. And what was pointed out to me is that this very much, Saul's reaction, Jonathan's reaction to the arrival of David in their life, very much mirrors potentially our reaction to the arrival of Christ in our lives. Saul's reaction to David showing up in his life is, this is great. I can actually use David. I'm going to use him to slay my giants. And I'm going to use him to win my wars and to fight my battles. And when I'm really sad and when I'm really down and when life is really hard, I'll call him in to play the lyre and soothe my soul. When I find myself in places where I'm in a really tight spot and I really need him, David is the exact tool in the tool belt to pull out and be a part of my life and use him in that way. Thank you, David, very much. But as soon as David's name starts to become bigger than Saul's name, as soon as David begins to inch towards the throne that Saul wanted, Saul hated him and ran him out of his life. Do I need to connect the dots for you on how you and me and we sometimes respond to Jesus like that? I'm not going to insult you by doing that. I think you see it. Meanwhile, Jonathan's response to David's arrival in his life, to knowing that David is going to sit on the throne that belongs to me, David is going to be the authority that I am supposed to be. David is going to have the reign that I'm supposed to have. David's going to be the leader that I'm supposed to be. And Jonathan's response is, good, take your throne. Here's my robe. Take your authority, not mine. It's not like he was giving it to him. Take your authority. It's rightfully yours. Jonathan surrenders his kingdom at the arrival of David. And many of us as Christians think that we responded to Jesus like Jonathan did. But I would just ask you this question. I don't think there's very few in here who are all Saul or all Jonathan. But which one are you closer to? And even when in some areas of our life we respond to Jesus like Jonathan responded to David, how long does it take for our real heart to shine through and begin to act like Saul again? When I'm in a tight space, I'll invite him in But when he seeks to control and change, then I invite him out. Whereas Jonathan gleefully, willingly, obediently did not give his throne to David. He simply assigned it to its rightful owner. With that, I am done preaching. But I am not done talking. I said talking until Chris coughed over it. It happens, pal. I don't do this ever. Because when I have the opportunity to preach, I really feel very strongly that a sermon is not life according to Nate. No one here came for my dopey colloquial wisdom about life. If you did, boy, you're in a tight spot. I believe wholeheartedly it is my job to teach the Bible and how it applies to us. But there is something in what I suppose is my pastor's heart that feels the need to say this to his church. But I want to be very clear that I'm not preaching. I'm talking to you as friends. I try to never do that. I try to never tell stories that make me look good. And I also try to never talk to just a subset of the audience, which I'm doing now. This is for the men. I'm just talking to the men. It's Father's Day, so I can do what I want. And I have thought this through, but I have not prepared it. So if you'll give me a bit of leeway to not go in my normal cadence. Men, our culture is suffering a deep loss of male friendship. Any statistic you look at from 1971 to 1991 to 2021, I did not pick those dates randomly. I looked at a survey that did that. Also, I'm not making this up. Would show you a stark decline in male friendship in the United States of America. There are more and more men who say, I don't have any close friends. And the sad truth is, the older you get, the more likely that is the case. There are fewer and fewer men who say they have more than three close friends. Young men, men age 30 and below, when the winds of life blow, are 2 to 3 times more likely to reach out to their parents than their friends because they don't have any. There is a dearth of male friendship in our culture. And that troubles me deeply because I'm blessed to have some. More than I deserve. And those are sacred to me. And I want you to have them too. Now, why is there a dearth of male friendship in our culture? Well, I'm sure there are myriad reasons. But I'll tell you what I think a big one is. There are those in different circles of Christendom and outside of Christendom who read the story of Jonathan and David and how it says that Jonathan loved him as he loved himself, and they were of one spirit. And how it says they kissed upon departure and they wept. There are those who look at the relationship of Jonathan and David and go, they were clearly in a homosexual relationship. They were clearly lovers, and that's why it hurt so much. And that makes me sad. And it doesn't make me sad for the reason that you might assume upon a pastor or presume upon a pastor. It makes me sad because I think that tells on the reader more than it tells on the subject. That our idea of masculine friendship is so atrophied and small that the only way to explain and comprehend for the male Western mind that two men would hug each other and weep and kiss upon departure is that they must be gay. I don't know what your definition of masculinity is. It's something I've thought about a lot. And one of the things I love about the story of David is he is, by all accounts, in different parts of the story, a man's man, according to Western manhood. He kills Goliath, chops off his head, he talks a great game. He says he's going to be delighted to watch the birds of the air and the beasts of the field eat the carcasses of your friends. He puts people to death. He wins wars. He's a warrior's warrior. David was also a musician. And I know that we all struggle with Aaron's masculinity, but I'm here to defend it today. I'm here to defend you, friend. David wept openly. David danced in his underwear before the Ark of the Covenant. David was a poet. There are many parts about David that you could isolate, and you could say, but he was a sissy. He was weak. But in the story of David, the Western mind is forced to encounter two seemingly opposing views of masculinity. But my suspicion is that part of the reason for the atrophy of male friendships in our culture is because of our response to stories like Jonathan and David, that for men to be so affectionate with one another, they can't possibly be straight. How sad. Let me tell you something, men, about male friendships. They require vulnerability. And they require affection. And if I wanted to just push a little harder, I would say to you gently, as kindly as I could, if you're scared of those things, if your natural reaction to someone hugging, to another man hugging you, or when another man says, hey, brother, I love you. If your natural reaction is to, oh, geez, dude, let's chill out. That's a you problem. I have some friends go to the church. And gosh, it has to be 4 or 5 years ago now. We had a really great night. One of our dear friends was moving away. We were sad. And so all four of us hugged and cried and kissed. I'm just messing around. We didn't do that. We have cell phones, so we knew we'd talk to him again, and it was good. But we had a great night. And boy, we laughed. And there was bourbon and cigars and all the things that you think accompany a night like that. And it's one of my all-time favorite nights. It's great. But with those friends, sometimes we'd go to lunch, sometimes we'd go to dinner, and sometimes we'd just get together. I found myself desiring that time less and less. Because I wanted more than what I just called the yuck yuck club. Where you get together and you share stories and you make each other laugh and you tell dumb things and it's funny and it's funny and it's funny, but eventually the stories start to repeat. And I wanted more. Got together with those same friends last week or week before last. And there was all the things that you think accompany that night, except this time there was some really good steaks. And after dinner, we were sitting on the back porch and we did our normal yuck yuck stuff. But all three of us have been seeing therapists for different reasons. And somebody asked, what's the most surprising or difficult thing that's come out of that for you? And we all just started answering. And we started encouraging each other. And we started celebrating each other. And let me tell you, that night wasn't near as fun. But if I can't have those nights, I don't want the other ones. Men, you need deep friends. You need friends that would weep if you left. You need friends who show up for you. You need friends who know everything about you and love you and help you pick up the pieces. And if what you understand it is to be a man prohibits you from having that, I would love to encourage you to rethink it. Let's pray. Father, thank you for loving us. Thank you for giving us the story of David, Jonathan, and Saul. Thank you for their friendship and what it was and how it stands out for us as what we should seek and what we know that we can find, God, because I believe that you want that for all of us. God, if we have men in our life, if we're men and we have men in our life that we love, I pray that we would have the courage to say it and to hug them and to mean it and to cry with them when it's necessary. God, for the women who are here, they need friends too. And so I pray that they would be grateful for those today, for those of us who have dads with whom we can be friends, for those of us who have sons with whom we can be friends. God, we are so grateful and we pray that those relationships that have morphed into wonderful friendships in adulthood would continue to flourish and point us towards you. God, I pray for friends in the life of every one of the men and women in this room that would come to them in times of need, that would be there to celebrate with them in times of trial, that would be shoulders to cry on and lean on. But God, would you make those places for us? And would we allow ourselves to experience the love that comes in a friendship like Jonathan and David's? It's in your son's name we ask these things. Amen.